Good afternoon, everyone. And on behalf of the Campus Community Committee, I'm very pleased to welcome everyone here to today's presentation. This is the time of the year when I think our anxiety levels are a bit up. After all, many of us come to work when it's still dark, and we go home when it's already dark. And it doesn't mean we come in too early or we go home too late, but this is one of the times of the year with the academic season in session, particularly exam times and so forth. There's a lot further activity. And then when you get a day like today with rain, sort of our levels go up as well. So I think the talk is an appropriate talk at this time of the year. We're very pleased to have Dr. Ian Bradley is our presenter. Ian is a psychologist trained at the University of Waterloo. They don't have a bad program over there.
Hey, thank you.
It was actually, at that time, it was the only Canadian school that was accredited by the American Psychological Association. He started off primarily doing his work with children, with stuff done in Los Angeles and autistic children with whom he worked with in Vancouver. Ian is an assistant professor in both departments of psychiatry and psychology, and he also teaches an undergraduate course in cognitive behavior therapy. He was a psychologist in chief of the Royal Victoria Hospital and led a team of over 30 different psychologists. Interesting enough that he changed the orientation of that particular group, moving from, shall we say, assessment testing to one really where they were doing active treatment in areas particularly stress management, depression, sexual dysfunction, and gambling itself. He's also served as the EAP psychologist for the National Hockey League Players Association, and probably many of them could use their services right now as they sit and twiddle their thumbs. And for the last 2 years of the Expos, while they were in town, he was also the mental health consultant. He specializes in the area of workplace psychology, now doing work for small and medium types of enterprises, as well as the fact that he's a practicing executive coach. So it's my pleasure now to introduce Dr. Ian Bradley, who's going to talk to us about Know Your Enemy Stressors at Work. Ian.
Great. Thank you. It's a pleasure. Thank you very much for the introduction. I just realized in the introduction that I'm going to be completely useless because I'm equally impaired by the lack of light and the rain. So environmental stressors are not my thing. I want to talk about, as I was coming down today, I was saying I'm feeling better in my life than I ever did before, and it's because I'm not like you, I hate to say this, in the sense that I'm not working with a lot of people, I'm not working for an organization, and I'm doing just what I love to do, which is psychology. And so I'm going to try to talk about that today, and the idea that sometimes it's that we love something, and that's why we go into it, but we end up hating it or being stressed because of the organizational context that that job is embedded in, or the people that you have to deal with. So I'm going to talk about those things as we go along. Let me just get over here. More formally, in terms of themes, I'm going to begin talking about four themes. The first one is a micro view of work. So I'm going to talk about the psychological importance of work, and then the importance that psychology drew from work. And that's kind of ambivalent, because on the one hand, psychology and psychiatry, we like it, and we also think it's useless. So we have this ambivalence about it. So we'll talk about that, the macro view of work. We'll talk about the nature of stress. And here's my take-home message, which I shouldn't deliver at the beginning, but rather at the end. My work is extremely simple. When I deal with patients, it's almost childlessly simple in terms of the problems. And my solutions, even though I think I'm relatively well-educated and experienced, are sometimes equally trivial. So I'm going to give you a model about stress that is simple, but it's complex because people are embedded in it, and they're so embedded in it that they can't see it. And that's what I'd like to argue about stress. The third one is a pet peeve of mine, and I hope you will indulge me as I go through this pet peeve. which is I don't think we treat people well who are disabled in the workplace. 50% of my practice is with people that are off on psychological reasons, either burnout, whatever that is, or depression or stress, and they're at home vegetating. And I think everybody is the loser. So I've got some ideas about that and see what you think about that. And then I'm going to end with some common stressors and solutions. So let me talk about the nature of work, and we do a lot of it, and this is a graph so that women, these are number of people that are working more than 50 hours a week, which is a considerable number of hours, and you can see that mostly professionals. Can you see that? So up to 38% of men who are professionals are working more than 50 hours. So there's a lot of us are working a lot, and you would think that if we're working a lot, then we wouldn't have this Sunday night anxiety. But we do we not? I think I was traumatized early on, even in public school, because I had this great enmity towards Ed Sullivan, and I couldn't figure out why. And it was because he was on Sunday night, and that meant the end of the weekend and the beginning of work, Monday. And to this guy, he explains it quite nicely. He said that we can never be happy at work because we'll never be free. That to Aristotle, any kind of paid work is automatically degrading. And so this quote, all paid jobs absorb and degrade the mind. How is that? So there's a loss of freedom. To him, of course, there were only two worthwhile pursuits. Either you were in politics, you didn't know Quebec politics, I guess, at the time, or philosophy. Those are the only two things. And the rest, you let a slave do. So but we know that it's important, and it's important for a couple of reasons, because when we're with people, after we talk about the rain, what do we talk about? What we do, right? It's a second, probably most common topic of conversation. And we do it in a way, I hate to say, that's competitive. We sort of let it out a little bit, and when we hear what the other person is doing, we put that person on some kind of totem pole. That could be in terms of salary or power or prestige or influence or whatever. So that's why a job is important. We talk about it a lot. It allows us to compete. It's a way, when I'm a psychologist, I'm a particular type of psychologist, so I can express myself in a way. It allows me to be creative. Another reason why work is important. You can be an accountant or a lawyer in your particular way. So it allows this expression. I have a physician right now who is relatively lonely, and he loves Monday because he's got loads of patient contact, and he loves it, and he socializes in this role of physician. So it gives us a huge social network. It's really important. This is probably the best one. Can you see that one? It's your identity. I am a psychologist, and I take it on when I go golfing, and we're on the second hole, we introduce ourselves, and we say where we are, I'm still a psychologist, and I carry that around. So that's five psychological reasons why it's important. But, who are we kidding? It's the money, right? Would we be here if we didn't get a salary? So this is the amount I have a graph here, the amount of lifetime earnings. This is obviously not Quebec after taxes, but it's a lot of money. And it starts off nicely, because when you think about what kind of job you want to go to and what you want to be trained in and what you want to do in life, it sounds nice. You imagine a lifestyle, you select a work that would give you that lifestyle, pay the bills, you fulfill the choice, and it starts off nicely, but then it ends up like this. All of a sudden, that these choices become obligations, and you're working to pay the bills of the obligations, and you're caught up in a vicious circle that you can't escape. And again, the lack of freedom, another stressor connected with this lack of freedom and how we catch ourselves in this cycle. Great book, and I'm going to reference books. It's going to sound like a book club, but this one by the essayist and philosopher Alain de Botton, The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work. And I love this quote. He said, the most important thing about work, it means, yeah, the end to freedom, but also the end to doubt, emptiness, and wayward desires. that he had a quote that we're only a few rogue cells away from palliative care. I'm sorry, we are. Thank God for our immune system, but it might. But we don't think about that. Why? Because we've got to write this memo. We've got to see a patient. We've got to get this report. So it distracts us from bigger things that maybe we don't have an answer to. You like any of these things? Why we work? When I'm with it, and it was mentioned in the introduction, I do right now a lot of executive coaching. I deal with managers and professionals and CEOs, and I ask them two questions. One, how important is work to you? And ask them a question about who's at work. And then the importance is, I can ask them various ways in terms of you as this role, as a lawyer or as a manager, how important is it compared to other roles? Being a husband, being a lover, being a father, whatever. How important is this role? Or how much time do you spend doing it? It's another way I ask about the importance of work. And these are huge figures that I get from people. 80% of their identity or 80% of their time, their non-sleeping time, is devoted to work. And then I ask them, who's there? Because we wear a mask when we come to work. And there are some people that wear only a partial mask, and there are some people that wear a complete mask. Some people go to work and they say, well, I have acquaintances at work, but no friends. I draw the line. So I have friends outside, but not inside. They know a certain part of me, but not the part that I keep for other people, my social network. That's all right to a certain extent, but that's another cause of stress if it gets to what this research talked about, a humiliation, that some people, either because of the nature of the job or the stress or the embarrassment of criticism, go to work with a huge mask, so they hide their identity almost completely and go through. They give the work hours, but not themselves at all. So they go with a very intense mask. And also, this is Belli's conceptualization. When we're at work, what is it? Because it's a job, which means that what's really important is the money. Right? It gives me something to do, and it's the money. A career is slightly different. There's formation, there's more identity in a career, right? You take the career with you when you leave at 5 o'clock. You don't with a job. A job ends at 5 o'clock when you leave. Or is it a calling? And a calling is something that involves meaning. So am I doing something that not only is my identity, but it reflects meaning? It doesn't have to be religious. It can be. You can be a nurse, and you can have the same job, and you can have three different nurses that view nursing as a job, as a career, and as a calling. And which one? And obviously, if you're viewing it just as a job, you're more likely to be stressed. The idea that I wanted to get across here is work has changed in a fundamental way. We were talking before about the role of technology and how technology has changed work, but even more fundamentally, work has changed. I shop at Costco, and I go on Saturday, and I can go, as you can go, in January and get fresh strawberries. I never think about where they come from. I remember growing up as a kid, I mean, all vegetables ceased when? In September. You could get anything. You get things that were canned or frozen or whatever else, but we never think about where things come from or the complexity of the supply chain. When I'm checking out at Costco and I'm registered that I bought this thing, probably in some factory in China or India, it's registered that I bought it. So a huge complexity of the supply chain that I'm completely unaware of, versus our fathers or our grandfathers that were intimately connected with work. They were close to production. They understood what work meant. Now work happens in technology parks or industrial parks that we don't see. I also have another, I don't know if it's because of some movies that are involving time travel lately, but I often say if I were to go back in time, like 300 years, like right now, zip, I'm back there, I mean, would I be valuable? I mean, I like to think of myself as, you know, semi-educated, but what could I tell them? I couldn't tell them about an iPhone. What could I? I'm a modern person. You think that I bring back? I can't make my clothes. I couldn't make my shoes. What could I do? I thought the only thing I'd tell them is wash your hands. Be sure to wash your head. That's really important, you know? So we're disconnected with work and the process. We're invisible consumers. And this is these are some jobs that I don't know what half these things are. MIS consultants. But you can just go down the list and see how the nature of work has changed. There's a psychologist that belongs to an organization of psychologists in management who tries to conceptualize this, and I like her conceptualization. Three steps. You can get a job if you take some mixture of quantitative or qualitative data. So you start there. And then you apply it to some product, program, or policy. And you measure at the end quality, value, or performance. And then you can make up a job with those permutations. And then you can call yourself anything. But all this is new, right? This never existed 100 years ago. So the nature of work has fundamentally changed. And also the nature of psychology and psychiatry's view of work. This is a, I don't know if you can see it, it's a photograph of the Douglas, and I worked there for after Vancouver I came here, and I was lucky to work with a psychologist from McGill, Ernest Poser, who hired me, and we eventually ran the behavior therapy unit here. But what do you notice? This is the Douglas. But striking impression from this is what? Somebody.
Large.
Large. Oh, you're genius. Thank you very much. Yes. And why? Why do we have a large? Well, two reasons. One, as a buffer, because this is an asylum and they're crazy people, so we want a buffer between them and the community. But that's not the most important reason. The most important reason relates to a revolution that occurred in psychiatric treatment in the 1800s, and which is the moral treatment, started by Quakers who said we can't keep mentally ill patients in chains, in semi-prisons, but they need a productive, work-filled life. Not only that, they need good food, maybe some spirituality, but they need work. And so all the asylums then were built with grounds around them, and they were farms. So the Douglas was a farm at the beginning, and patients worked. And there was a value in working as part of mental health to recover. The epitome was, if I don't know if you ski at Sunday River, but if you ski and you pass through Bethel, a small town, and 100 years ago, this was the Menningers of the time, and it was called the work cure. And there was at one time it was said that John Gehring had 30% of the male staff at Ivy League universities who came to his retreat to work in order to cope with stress. So, and work meant physical work, and that was the way to deal with stress. But I said that psychiatry and psychology were ambivalent. Here's a book. Well, let me just go on. There's another thing I wanted to talk about, which is still with the idea of the therapeutic value of work. I ask sometimes my students this question. What do you think the largest treatment center for mental health is in the world? And get very erudite answers. The Menningers or people from Toronto always say the Clark, or somebody says Betty Ford. But here's and that from another great book, The Power of Habit. It might be Starbucks. That's what I'm arguing. It might be Starbucks because they teach barista, average length of training is 30 hours. Half of that is devoted to actually making the coffee, but the other half is how to deal with angry, disgruntled clients. And they teach social skills. And there's this great book called The Power of the Habit that I would encourage you to buy. It's a bestseller right now. And in it, there's a story about a young man, Travis, from a ghetto environment. He saw his father die of an overdose of heroin on the floor and was hopelessly lost in addiction and crime. And then he was hired as a barista, and it changed his life in terms of the social skills and the sense of work that the organization gave. So that's the therapeutic power of work. But I said we're ambivalent, and this is what I wanted to say before. You get the opposite, and I'm sure this is not a book on, you know, at least on the top shelf of your bookshelf. It's called Fat and Blood. Fat and Blood. Not a very appealing title, but it reflects the idea that this chap, Dr. Weir, invented a cure just the opposite, the rest cure. So the patient was instructed to lie in bed for 24 hours a day for months, mostly women, by the way, were the patients. Special nurse would sleep on the cot in the room, feed her, keep her mind from morbid thoughts by reading poetry or whatever. and visits from family and friends were discouraged. So that was the total rest. And we have both right now, and we can't decide. We tell people to go and rest, and it's going to make them better, and we tell them to go and work. So we have these conflicting views. Let me talk a little bit about stress. So how many of us are stressed, and we're psychologists, and we like questionnaires, and usually there's a Likert scale of 5 points, and we say that the people that are answer 4 or 5 are really stressed, and so we count those, and we get about 27% in the latest one, and 2-10, so that the number of people that are significant are extremely stressed. And there's a high proportion of those that say, it's the job. That's why I'm stressed. It's unlikely to be home or other things. And those people are likely to be well-educated and professional. And why is this important? Because if you're stressed, you're likely to be off work with physical symptoms or burnout, psychological stress. And the problem is, too, is that if you're not back within a short period of time, you're likely never to come back. So I don't have the curve, and I'd like to see the shape of the curve, but after a year, only 2% of people come back if they've been off on disability. So it is a problem. This is an obligatory slide that everybody presents, right? It's the cost. And if I was talking about hemorrhoids, I'd have the same slide, right? The cost. I just made up the numbers, by the way. They're all bogus. I just made it up. It's just because everybody has to do this. But there is a cost. And the other thing that bothers me about this is that it might be a cost, but it's my revenue. Right? I hate to say it. I mean, I don't know why we do this. I mean, it's somebody's cost, but it's another person's revenue. Right? So why do we do this? I mean, but there is a problem. And insurance companies are paying more and have more people off for psychological reasons for disability now than ever before. It's the fastest growing claim. So that's the introduction about work, the ambivalence about it, the importance about it. Now, I want to give you now, talk about stress, and I want to give you a simple model, a general model about stress, and see how we use it. And to show you that stress really at its most fundamental is simple. And just three components. There's an external demand in the environment that interacts with our capacities, that we try to meet that demand in some way. And then that product yields stress. So if our own capacities can't meet the demand, then it gets translated into stress. The external demands, sometimes they're quite obvious and sometimes they're not. And again, can I direct your attention to this great book called Zubiquity? And the whole purpose of the book, it's written by veterinarians arguing that people doctors need to know more about veterinarian medicine. And it was actually written by a cardiologist in connection with veterinarians. But the cardiologist, Natterson Horowitz, she was about to, with the aid of the veterinarian, anesthetize, prior to intubation, she was going to anesthetize this primate of, I don't know what kind of primate, but she looked at it and smiled at the primate just before the injection. And the veterinarian looked at her, grabbed her, said, "Stop that!" And she says, "Why?" And she said, "Have you ever heard of captive gaze? This could cause cardiac myopathy. Can cause, you are thinking what a beautiful little animal this is, and the animal's thinking, I'm going to be eaten. I'm going to be eaten." And that's such a thing, of course. It's cardiac myopathy. It happens about 20% of animals that are fixated with a predator's eyes. So sometimes stressors are not terribly obvious, and this is an example of how some people can misconstrue them, but most of the time I would argue that the demands are quite obvious, and I've listed general ones and specific ones like organizational change. Right now, job insecurity, especially on Sunday night, that's a huge one. Will I keep my job? Lack of authority or how to exercise authority, that's a big one. Am I being too hard or am I being taken advantage of? That's the dialectic when you're managing people. I don't want to be Attila the Hun, but on the other one, I don't want to be a sap. So where is the middle? So a lot of managers deal with that dialectic. Where are they going to be in the middle? Ambiguity is another one. I remember when I started off as chief psychologist at the Royal Vic, I was waiting for somebody to phone me to tell me what to do. And I was there 28 years, and the phone call never came. completely undefined as to what I was going to do. And I realized after a while that I had to make this up myself. So that causes stress, the ambiguity. So there are general stressors that I think that apply to everybody, but what appeals to me, and especially because I love my job right now, and it's an education for me to see people in various professions. So I think there are very specific stressors for, and so I tried to gear this a little bit. So for professors, university professors, what's a major stressor is a sense of respected territory, that this academically is my field. People recognize that and give me license in that field versus a department where that's not recognized and you've got three experts in the same field. They're at each other's throat. In mathematics, I was talking to various people in mathematics, and there are two types of mathematicians, I think, at higher levels anyhow, which are mere mortals and geniuses. And if you're not a genius, don't apply. So the question there, are you a genius? And then the chair in the department, where you have to use moral suasion. You can't fire people. You can't give them stock options. How do you motivate them without that authority? And so then that certainly is a stressor. So going back to this original model here, we've got this external demand. We've got internal coping. And so when something happens, like where organization changes or there's more work to do, we can work harder, smarter, change the meaning of it. We can say, well, maybe work's not important. What's really important is dancing. So I'm going to become a great tango dancer. So you can change the meaning. So you can do all kinds of things acting on the external demand, right? That's one way of coping. Or you can cope the other way. You can try to modulate the stress, which is the product. And you can do that by a variety of things. One of the big things right now is meditation, mindfulness, and it's fine, but it's no better than any of the other somatic techniques. And in fact, I'm able to tell people in 30 seconds a type of diaphragmatic breathing that probably most of you know that is extremely effective in terms of somatic calming and coping. Distraction, getting people on your side at home. Don't you realize what an asshole my boss is? That kind of social support is so important, eh? And so that you have people on your team at home. So those are the ways to cope. But what happens when the capacities don't meet the demands? So here's a little one. So under resources, we've got attention, the ability to pay attention. And then here, when we're excessively aroused and stressed, what happens? We don't pay that much attention to what it is we're supposed to do. And then that leads to poor work performance. Our performance is bad. We're disappointed at ourselves. That increases the demand because we're not performing as much as we should. And then that leads to decreasing confidence, and we're losing confidence. See, it's a mess. That's why I say it's simple, but it's complex. And this is the model of what happens to people in burnout or stress. Let me emphasize it another way. And what makes it complex as well is the number of signs of stress, because stress is a coordinated physiological and psychological response. And it happens in five major domains. It happens in the physiological domain. So you can have mimicking diseases across the board. You can have gastrointestinal problems, migraines, blushing, high blood pressure, all kinds of things. You can have vegetative problems, sex problems, lack of eating, sleep problems, behavior, emotive, cognitive. So that you can have a symptom in any one of these. And the most important thing is that any one of these symptoms can become a node, that you then can have a whole trail of negative things that happen. So I've just picked one. And again, it's going to seem simple to you. You're going to say, well, this is like, it's so simple. But it's not simple for the people that are doing it because they're thinking quickly. They're thinking these ideas, but all at once. So here's a node of, this is sleeping, so I'm worried at night. So you go to bed, there's something that on your mind, and it wakes you up. It's some task to do. Woke up at 2 o'clock, couldn't get back to sleep. Oh, gee, what happens if it happens tomorrow? I'm going to think about it in the afternoon. I might not sleep tonight. Oh, gee, the idea of not sleeping is stressful. I'm going to worry about it. I panicked last night. How can I work if I'm tired? If I'm really tired, I'm not going to be able to meet my expectations at work. I'm going to lose my job. All that happens, a concatenation of causal factors that you imagine, but instantaneously. So, and it can happen with any nose. So I have one here, there's another one sweating. You can take any one of these symptoms, and then you can have a trail. And this is sweating, so will it be noticed? I'm going to fight to make sure that I don't sweat. And of course, I sweat more. And what will people think of me, that I'm weak. And if they think I'm weak, I'm not going to be able to have the image that I want. So all these things lead to more and more stress. That's why I think a model of psychological disturbance isn't really can't be adequately described by a medical model. A more apt model is the idea that life is a minefield. We fall into holes we're bound to. I don't spend much time with clients asking them why. I don't spend much time asking them about their childhood and saying why you fell in that hole. What I try to do is take away that shovel that they're invariably using to get out of the hole. And these are the shovels. These dramatic things that they say to themselves and the concatenation of symptoms that follow. So that's a model of stress. And then I try to tell them, and they don't believe me, of course, at the beginning, because they're so embedded in this, that I'm saying that there are negative cycles, vicious cycles, but there are also positive ones. That if you start exercising, or if you start calming down, or if you start doing something else, then you can build upon that. And that can happen as quickly as the negative cycles. I know you don't believe me now, but it really is true. And so part of my job is sales, convincing people that you can have these positive cycles as well. So take home message, life is like a minefield. We're sooner or later falling into it. Okay. What I see when people come to me with workplace disability. I thought of this as a play. You ready? Scene one? Scene one is very reasonable because they can tell you exactly what the problem is. And it could be a combination of any one of these things, the task. There's too much work to do, right? They can say. Or maybe they'd say the problem is me. I'm disorganized, or this is beyond my capacity. Or my boss is not giving me any direction, or she is critical. Or the climate is nobody's supportive. We're all enemies. We're all fighting each other. But they can tell you what it is. But this stress mounts and mounts and mounts, but it's still quite explicable and logical, right? And then it gets to a certain point that I call scene two, the decision. Remember, I don't know, when you were young, I don't know, in grade three, and you woke up, the alarm went off, or maybe your mother came in, and you had a bit of a sore throat. And you'd sort of say, well, I got this spelling test today. I wonder, but I got Jim. I like Jim. I don't like the spelling test. I can convince my mom, but my mother had a habit of giving me things called mustard plasters. I don't know where she got this. It baked the hell out of my chest. So that was a negative. So that was like the spelling. But the point is that people go through this decision. Am I going to leave work or not? And the researchers in Sherbrooke call it a decisional balance, that they weigh the pros and cons of leaving work on a disability. It just doesn't happen unconsciously, that people go through this weighing. Quite naturally, I'm going to get my salary, but I'm going to disappoint my boss. If I leave now, will I ever go back? But they weigh these things. Scene three, it's the nice doctor. And by the way, if your doctor isn't nice, all I have to do is go to a CLSC and get another doctor who doesn't know you. And a couple of tears really helps, especially if you're a woman. Right? But you don't want to screw it up. And you can screw it up by going in there, like you can screw it up a medical appointment by saying, gee, I think I'd like some Cipro. What? You're not a doctor? What do you mean you'd like some Cipro? You go in and you talk about your symptoms, right? So the same idea here. You don't go in and say, I'd like some time off. No, you go in, I'm stressed. I'm not sleeping. I'm worried about my whatever. Right? You present your, and then the final decision is the doctor saves you time off. Well, what's the problem with this? The problem is that, one, the doctor doesn't know much about your work. The doctor knows about you, maybe, and he knows, he's listening to your symptoms. He knows you're suffering. There's no doubt about that. But the prescription is one, I call it a medical kind of sanctuary, because invariably, the ones that I've seen, it's stay home, rest, take medication. All those things, I think, are disasters. Maybe not the medication, but the evidence shows the placebo is just as good as an antidepressant, but that's another topic. And there's this fundamental transformation that takes place, because here on this top part of the curve, everything is explained. It's all reasonable. With a boss like that, I can understand it. With that kind of work, but then all of a sudden with the letter, we no longer have a distressed worker. We've got a patient. We've got suddenly this quantum change into a patient. And now we've got a patient that's suffering with the symptoms that I outlined, lack of sleeping, they're worried about that, the stress, the sweating, whatever else. And that's the focus, no longer the cause. The cause is forgotten. And now it's management of the symptoms. So it's medically driven, it becomes patient-focused rather than worker-focused, and of course it becomes shrouded in an element of confidentiality. We treat this like we do cancer, for example. So somebody, if you're having a serious illness, so you deserve to have privacy. But we do the same idea, and this is Michael Wilson, our ex-minister of finance, who was on a great committee looking at workplace disability, arguing for this. Employers do not need to know the nature of the diagnosis of the disabling illness that is involved in any given case. This information is private and confidential. Well, they don't need to know about whether you've got high blood pressure, but they need to know about the problems that started this, I think. And to treat it just like a patient with medication, I think, is a disservice. So the saga continues. Does the patient rest at home? No, they never rest. They ruminate. They just go over what happened in their mind. They relive what happened. They think, and this is going to continue, and they see little hope for it. They don't improve their skill set. There's very little contact with coworkers. Rarely does the boss phone. In good disability management programs, there's immediate contact. I'm not sure what it is at McGill, but there are some companies that within 24 hours, the person is contacted by somebody in HR and maybe even the boss. And it's so vital that the workplace retains contact with the person at home, because if they're not, the people that do make contact, however, sometimes are a part of the problem, because sometimes then the insurance company farms it out to a disability management company and you get critical calls saying, why aren't you back at work? What are you doing? Are you taking the medication? And you get hounded by the disability management person who has no idea what you do for a living, doesn't work for the insurance company or your employer, just is on a contract to get you back at work as soon as possible. So I think it's a disservice. The company... I think is suffering too. The formative problem that started it is ignored. The manager is missing production targets. And coworkers pick up the slack, but they know if they went to a doctor, they could probably do the same thing. Most coworkers could, on a bad day, they could go and present themselves to a doctor and get a similar letter and get a similar kind of psychological leave. And of course, increase insurance costs. So I think what's happened because of this, because I consider it a mess, is that insurance companies have so many people off that they're coping. And how do they cope? Well, we play DSM games. They say, is the person really sick? And if they're not really sick, then they can't be off on disability and we're not going to pay their salary. And the question is, what does really mean? So in mental health, it means, do they have a DSM, you know, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual? Do they qualify for that diagnosis of depression, for example? Is it major depression? Who cares? Yeah, minor, medium depression, the person's suffering. But in order to save money, there's a whole sort of a coterie of experts in psychiatry that do medical expertise, and you go to them, one of them, they interview you, and they pronounce in an 11-page paper whether you're DSM qualified or not. And if you're not, your disability is cut off. So that's how we're coping. We're turning this into an adversarial system. So the company's fighting their own employees. And this is a researcher here in Quebec was saying in one company, 70% of the claims were being contested. Can you imagine your employer's not believing you in 70% of the cases that you're disabled? What I suggest and what I think we need is something that's less medicalized. I think a physician has a role, but I think a psychologist has a more important role. I think there should be a medical voice, but not the driving voice and not this medical kind of sanctuary. I think that person needs not rest, but development. They need to, if physical development, one of the things that I encourage people to do is start an exercise program. Do not rest. Start walking. Right? And if you can walk, then go to the gym. And also, it's a time for problem solving. What went wrong? What can we do differently? It should be a red flag to the organization that this unit is a problem. And we have to investigate every aspect about this. The climate, the job, the task, the managerial style. And sometimes I'm involved in that process, but not as much as I would like. One of the things that I use, and this is the last I'll say about it, is that a lot of people that are away on disability become so phobic about the idea of returning. It's filled with just so much anxiety that I've had people that have thrown up even walking by their place of employment, let alone. So the cure is, I'm afraid, you get back on the horse. So we try to get them to make contact with friends or whatever, leading up to what I call the lunch. And this is after working with them for a long period of time, and trying to make sure their symptoms, their physical symptoms, are under control. But having a lunch well prepared for, where they can confront their boss or their coworker or whatever with the problem. So they bring it up. It's critical that you have to, with my support and help from other people, and it does work. Preventative approach, targeting high-risk areas, looking at your statistics and human resources to see where people are off, reviewing job design, looking at climate, general stress management. So that's the third topic. I'll just potpourri of some of the things that that I see in individuals. Well, to-do list. We all have them, right? To-do list. They're both great and also a bane of our existence. Why do we like it? We like it because it gives us a plan, that's for sure. It gets things out of our head. I'm going to talk about this later on, the importance of getting things out of working memory. It's so important. Don't try to keep things in working memory. Our capacity is 7 chunks. You have 8 and you're in trouble, you're stressed, write it down, put it on your smartphone or whatever. So a list does that. It gives us a sense of control, a sense of order. But what else does it do? I'm convinced that we love the scratch, don't we? Can you just feel it now? Can you imagine just going through that? Isn't that a nice feeling? It is a nice, it's one of accomplishment, eh? But I warn you, it is both good and it is bad. Because some people get hooked on it, the sense of accomplishment. And I'll give you some examples of a man urinating and looking at his BlackBerry at the same time. It comes from this. It comes from this because you buy a philosophy of always achieving and you're never off. You're never off. And that philosophy seeps into your life. So that's a huge cause of stress. We have to realize that we'll never complete it, right? We always start, and why never don't we learn this? Because we always start off saying, oh, gee, this is a list, but maybe it's too much. Then we realize we didn't complete it. So I'll do fewer items the next day. No, I'll do even more on my to-do list. We never learn, right? But in the back of your mind, remember this talk, remember my voice, and say, you will not complete this. Don't expect it. Don't stay at work till 8 o'clock thinking that you're going to do it, because if you do it, there are going to be new ones tomorrow anyhow. So don't get caught up in this. And then I have people that have a full day in terms of accomplishment. But the problem is that they were accomplished things that weren't on their to-do list. So the managers that went out, left their office, and were grabbed, buttonholed by somebody, and they ended up doing something on the other person's to-do list, and they did all day like that. They were extremely productive, but at the end of the day, they said, I didn't do anything. And what do they mean? They didn't do anything on their own to-do list, right? So be careful of that kind of delusion. You're working. It's not just. It still counts. Just because it wasn't on your to-do list, it still counts. And accept the idea that you're not going to accomplish everything. So that's one point, to-do list. Another thing that I see in my practice is this dialectic between cooperation and competition. And it was mentioned that I work for the Expos, and this player will be unnamed, but I thought this is a great quote. You want to be the best, but you can't show it too much or you'll be an asshole. I thought, yeah, that's it. That's true with all of us. Psychologists, there's a subtle competition. You were in sight when I was running rounds as who was the most insightful. Yeah, we've all got PhDs, but who's more empathetic and deep, right? It wasn't spoken, but it was palatable in terms of competition. So we all want to be number one, right? And it happens with individuals, but it also happens in another book that I'd like to direct your attention to. It's called The Evolutionary Theory of Economic Change. These economists argue it also happens among organizational units. So it happens among individuals and units working, obviously, for the same company. So companies are comprised of fiefdoms where executives compete for power and control. Divisions compete for resources and sabotage each other for glory. You don't think it's true? It is. It is all the time. And they might be working the same for IBM, but the big mainframe guys are against the software guys, against the business consultant guys, and whatever. It happens all the time, as I was fighting psychiatry for 25 years as chief psychologist. So how you balance this and how you advance your career, because if you try to advance your career by being number one, it's not going to work. So I often consult with people who are stuck in their career, and I talk about career advancement by helping others, by being an aid to other people. And that's the way. It's not by self-aggrandizement. It's not by self-promotion. It's by helping others. We talk about strategy. Who do you want to impress? So we talk about strategic thinking. Who do you want to impress? How do you want to impress? These things are never discussed in business school, but extremely important in career development. And that's one of the rules that I... Interpersonal, I love this quote by Kadwa. People get hired for their skills and fired for their personality. Isn't that true? When we assess people, we always look at their skills and then it's their personality that does them in. So the number of people that I see that suffer from critical bosses or people with bad temperaments. And here's another book. They don't teach corporate in college. And I'm just surprised because I go into businesses, especially small businesses, and they don't do this. And it just strikes me as maybe because I've worked in a university environment or a hospital that we just don't talk about religion, politics, and sex. But I've been in some companies where I think everybody's reading 50 Shades of Grey. I mean, that all the time. That's they talk about on Monday. Who'd you sleep with? I mean, it sounds silly, but that's what happens. This is not going to work. How many more minutes do I have? Two more minutes? This is an obligatory slide, right? I'm a psychologist. I have to show you a rat. Maybe you can't see it, but this rat is pressing a lever, and you know the old thing, and this lever is connected by relay to food so that you do something, you get a reward. Versus this little guy, he's running away from something. So that there's a buzzer that comes on, and 3 seconds later, a shock comes on, and to avoid the shock, he has to jump over in the side. Both are equally good ways of teaching people and animals new behavior. Both are equally great. But if you do the second one, and if your life is dominated by the second one, you're going to have a lot of stress. And recently I met a young woman who was burned. She was hired in her job, and they said, that we wanted a creative person in this job. She was creative and coming up with, she had a planned meetings. She did. She invited people that she thought were relevant, and her boss dumped on her. And what did she learn? To check everything out. And to check everything, going to run it by. And it was like she was buying an insurance policy against criticism. But the problem is that the premium was paid each and every day. It wasn't as if, like, we have household insurance, and I think of a fire maybe when I'm writing the check once a year. But she was paying this premium every day. So every time she had an idea, she would go and check it by. So she was living to avoid censure and working to avoid censure. She is successful, but stressed. Okay. What else do I want to talk about? Last one, and I'll end here. Don't have to go to Harvard to get an executive MBA. If you're a manager, do these 4 points. They were never done when I was working. No boss that I've ever worked for did these things for me. Tell the people what they're supposed to do. Have very specific goals, well-defined. Train your people to make sure that they can achieve them and give them the tools. Number of people that are just running on bad software or antiquated equipment have very good goals, but their equipment doesn't allow them to achieve it. Measure their performance. periodically, measure how they're achieving those goals. And the last one is most important, reward and recognize. I spend so much time with executives telling them, why don't you compliment? The answers are incredible. Well, if I compliment, they'll stop. If I tell somebody it's a good job, that's going to be the end. They're going to reach there. Just the opposite. It's oil that makes it work better. It unleashes what's called discretionary effort. It gets people to work even harder. I don't know how to commit. They're so scared. If I say good job, they're going to quit. No. Just the opposite. They'll work harder. Right? Do those four things. You know, be a great manager. We'll have less people on disability. And we'll understand work and stress better. Great talking to you. That's it.
Thank you very much, Ian, for the very enjoyable talk. And I think you focused on many issues that we all face. When I get back to the office, I'm going to take out my pen. And
but not too much.
Not too much. And then we'll take a deep breath. We don't have that much time right now, but we do still have a couple of moments for questions. So if there are any questions from the audience, I'll be more than happy to entertain. If you have a question, please just press your microphone so the light will come on and we'll know where you are. Questions?
One. Give me one.
Dora?
Oh, this is it. Your last slide there, talking about giving people the tools, what about creating tool makers, not tool takers? In other words, giving them the ability to make their own tools.
Oh, great idea. Because the last slide that I wanted to talk about was the importance of autonomy as a modulator of stress, and the idea that if people can create and decide upon their own way of achieving the goal, then that increases motivation 100 points and 100-fold and decreases stress. So sure, I like that very much. Yeah, great idea.
Yes, just press the button, please.
Hi, thanks for the talk.
Sure.
In psychology textbooks, when they talk about stress at work, they're very frequently they say that the research says that work that is stressful is workful, that is work that is repetitive, in which people have no choice and so on. I've got all kinds of choice and it's not repetitive. How come I feel stressed?
We'll talk. Come in. No, I agree. I think that was true a long time ago when we were talking about manufacturing jobs. Sure. That you talked about somebody that was doing the same thing, and what was really important is job enrichment. So getting people to have a variety of tasks. But the world of work has changed. We're no longer in that mass production, long-run production manufacturing world, so I think those things are wrong. I think control is very important. The second aspect, you said redundancy and control. I think control is important, that you have a sense of how you're doing it. It's related to the first question, that you contribute to the way something could be done. If you can't select the goals, then at least you have a choice in an autonomy and how they should be achieved. So I think that's important. And there's strong research that control is a modulator, at least for coronary heart disease, in terms of modulating work stress. Yeah?
No, you want to press it so
like that?
Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering, from your point of view, from the employee side,
yes,
what is the best way to approach the employer to discuss any of these
points?
Stressors at work? Mm-hmm.
Oh, I mean, there's so many different answers, right, depending on the circumstances. Maybe having somebody from outside to modulate the discussion, ideally, this is human resources. But the problem with human resources departments is they're so preoccupied with payroll and labor negotiations that they don't have the interest or the expertise in this. So having a third person, I think, is good. Having a retreat or staff training that looks upon this and then follows it up, I think, is extremely important. I think it's very useless to go away for a half a day or 3 hours and just end there. But to go away and broach some of these topics and say, we're going to have this as a continuing follow-up and we'll meet next year to see the results, I think that could help too. Maybe those things. Yeah, great question.
If now I think people are stressed out looking at the
Yes, exactly. Yeah, great.
So Ian, thank you very, very much.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you very much.